But today is VE Day. The war is
the
over.
The newly crowned queen waves from the balcony.
Eagle has landed. Apollo 11 has landed.
Tearing down the Berlin Wall.
Since 1929, the Monks Investment Trust's mission has been to help investors grow their wealth. We aim to do this today by taking a three-dimensional approach to growth. Cyclical growth, rapid growth, and steady growth.
The World Wide Web.
Wall Street is in turmoil as stocks crash.
The Monks Investment Trust, managed by Bailey Gifford. Capital at risk.
Hello and welcome back to The Advice Show with me, Julian Bovell. This week we're joined by Rich Fox and Ronan O'Riordan from Schroders. Thank you both for joining me.
Thanks for having us.
Well, Rich, why don't we start with you? It's been a big few months from a policy perspective, both from the government but also a pensions perspective. Can you sort of talk us through initially what you've been working on over the last few months?
But you're absolutely right. Like, and I've worked for Schroders for about 3 years, and I'm our head of policy. And if you'd have told me when I joined that kind of about half of my job would be pensions, I don't think I'd have believed you. Yeah. But all of a sudden, pensions are sexy. So look, there's an awful lot of I could cover anything, but why don't we start with what do I think is kind of the most important reason why this is so front and center? And for me, that's adequacy. In this move from DB to DC, it's talked about a lot, but what that is revealing about people's finances, I think, is pretty sobering, and why the policymakers are so focused on it. So if you look, there are different ways of measuring this, but Hargreaves Lansdown did some great research that came out in the summer. And they say that if you take the kind of living pension or Pensions UK's minimum pension, so that's meant to be the minimum you really need to live on in retirement.
To survive, basically, yeah.
They think only about 80% of households are on track for that.
Yeah.
So, like, turn that around, one in five households is not on track for a minimum pension.
Yeah.
And then if we go up a bit, Pensions UK have a moderate, so a bit more freedom, a few more luxuries, a bit more financial comfort. That's 16% of people. So I think no wonder, and credit to policymakers for trying to get on that. And then they're attacking it from all angles. The Pensions Commission's going to be how much goes in. The Pensions Bill's looking at the structure. And then I guess partly where asset managers like Schroders come in, every pound needs to work harder for people, I think.
Rich, you mentioned the Pensions Commission there. One thing that perhaps might be contrary to it is reports around salary sacrifice. What impact might that have on the amount people are able to save?
The first thing I think to say is, even more so than a normal budget, that the long lead time, and like, frankly, we were talking about it off air, weren't we?
We were, yeah.
Very long lead time. And the amount of, what's the right way to put it? Like, challenges that the government is trying to reckon with means that, even more so than normal, speculating on the budget, I think it's just a tricky game right now.
Absolutely.
So I really,
enough of that out there,
well, I really would say wait and see on the day. But to your question, that tension between the possibility that pensions could be a source of revenue for the government, look, I think is that's obvious, that's factual. So if they are going to do anything in that space, how do they reconcile that with confidence, certainty, in something that really is a really long-term product?
Yeah.
So I don't want to duck it. I think the tension between those two things, getting adequate pensions and changing the tax of pensions, I think is real, but it's just one of sort of any number of tightropes that the Chancellor's having to walk. So
yeah,
it's going to be difficult, I think.
Absolutely. And Ronan, one thing that Rich mentioned there about pensions being sexy since the government came in, last year, we're speaking again off air about mandation and the threat of mandation. I know that you brought in some quite interesting stats for us on LGPS and what people think about investing in their local area. Can you give me a little bit of insight into your work?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, within LGPS, there's been a lot of activity talking about using, let's use the sexy word. I mean, pooling has created a lot of conversations. I've created a lot of conversations around the impact of pooling and what that can do in terms of having greater pools of capital. I think what was interesting, we just released a study last week where we surveyed a lot of the underlying authorities, but also members and of officers within the pools. And one of the key stats that jumped off the page very quickly for us was that 2/3 of respondents do not favor mandating local investment or venture investment. I think that's really interesting. And if you look further into the data around that, it is about returns. It's about opportunities to invest as well. So when you're mandated, you're kind of obliged to do it. Whereas yeah. right now they want to do it more opportunistically, which I think is correct in terms
carrot
of
rather than stake.
Exactly. And I think we as a, you know, as a wider investment community need to develop those opportunities for them to actually prove that they are worth the investment opportunity that might be offset by investing in passive equities, for example. So I think there's a bit of push and pull there, but I think as a market, we're really starting to talk about this and, as you say, really create that energy around it, which is interesting, which I think is having the effect of mandation,
yeah.
but it's not with the tag of mandation.
And what can the government do to ensure that that pipeline, I think the word that Torsten Bell uses often, is there for companies like Schroders and I suppose your clients? Customers to invest.
Again, I think that, look, it's written in that, you know, in certainly in DC space by 2035 on the last, and Rich has got a lovely analogy of how to do that.
Yeah.
You know, he can still press the button in that period, in the last day. I think that overhang or the threat there, and we use the analogy of carrot and stick, looms large. And people are proactively engaging with private markets and allocations to private markets now across the full spectrum. So again, it's looking at the idea of being a fiduciary and saying my responsibility ultimately is to the beneficiary. I think between DC and LGPS, there's a slightly different mandate, as in you are local, ultimately a local authority, money supporting local companies in regions.
Yeah.
So you can be a bit more regionally focused. DC has a broader UK mandate, and then obviously outside of that, more global mandate to deliver returns for clients. Yeah. We are at the very early stages of this, as in if you look at allocations broadly in DC, they're still small. And we are moving towards an environment of, yes, there is more money coming. And the market's responding really well to that and providing opportunities, looking at UK venture, working in collaboration with universities, social housing, etc. So I think I'm quite excited over the next couple of years that we will develop those opportunities. I just think careful of the word mandation.
Yes, absolutely. It's a word that perhaps scares people. I know that both of you have been close to this work, and Richard Oldfield, I suppose both of your bosses, has said that DC savers haven't been getting the best value for what they're putting in. Rich, can you enlighten us a bit about the industry sort of shift from cost to value and what Schroders are trying to do?
Yeah, honestly, I'd love to take this on because I think it dropping down a level, because I completely agree with Ronan. You say the word mandation, like you see the hairs go up on people's arms, like people's backs yeah. get up.
Well, people don't like being forced into stuff, do they?
Right, and I completely get that. But I worry that just simply that heat means we're not having the more important conversations. And I think there's two big ones.
Okay.
So one is cost over value.
Yeah.
So let's do the cost one first. So we have a charge cap in DC pensions of 75 basis points.
Yeah.
Everybody knows that. The government legislated, it was quite controversial, to set a floor on fee. A ceiling on fees.
Yeah.
But we are nowhere near that in the market. Like, it is something in the order of the average fee is sort of 20 or 25 basis points. And
so our 50 off 50, basically.
Yeah. Right. And our colleagues tell us that they are often in pitches where they're just told, I'm sorry, the competition is all in for sort of 15, 19 basis points. And when I say all in, the systems charges, communication, everything. Mm. So colleagues have seen real pitches where there are 5 basis points for investment. Now, look, when Schroders has this conversation, we're an active asset manager, and people say, well, of course you want bigger fees because you want people to buy what you do. Put that to one side, 5 basis points. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't want 5 basis points doing the most important bit of my pension.
Yeah.
Right? Now, the problem, I think, is where that is the competition point in the market, it's hard for people to make a stand and say, I'm sorry, you can't do well for that. Yeah. I'm going to charge a bit more for something better.
Yeah.
Because someone will undercut you. So that is why I think the government's value for money work and through the regulators is so important.
Yeah.
Because I don't know about you, I don't want the cheapest value, as in value range. Like, I don't go into the supermarket and always buy the value thing. I certainly don't want my pension that's going to look after my future.
Taking buying dinner for your wife.
Right, come back with only blue and white stripes. I'm not, maybe it's not going to go down well.
Yeah.
So So I think shifting to that long-term return mindset is so important, I think.
And how can companies like Schroders be the first movers on that? I mean, is there a scenario where you just have to accept you're going to miss out on business and just bolt, be the first horse to bolt, as it were?
Do you want to take that as your trustee hat? No.
Well, one way we have been a first mover is we've done this. So one of the ways that I think now there's more or less collective wisdom, it accepts that introducing some private asset allocations is one way to get those different returns and start to move up that curve. Well, Schroders is doing that in its own pension scheme. So we have one of our long-term asset funds in the default scheme of our pension scheme. And again, people listening to this might say, well, of course you do. But hold on a sec, it's not a Schroders decision. That is the pension trustees. Mm. They're independent. They have to think about value for members. They had to weigh all the fees. I know they drove there's a lot of bargaining between them and ours on those fees. That is an example, I think, of really kind of walking the walk as well as talking the talk.
Yeah, if you just cast your mind back, how do you think the UK got to this position where cost was so incentivized over value? I mean, has it just been a sort of race to the bottom in that sense? Or, Ren, do you want
to... I'm happy to pick that up. I think yes. I mean, bear in mind the move to Master Trust meant an awful lot of client acquisition. So companies moved their default position away from DB into DC, and those that were building very viable and large businesses around Master Trust were competing against each other rather than to the benefit of the member. I think we're starting to see a turning point in that, and a lot of that acquisition has been done. So looking at it more from a value for money lens is now definitely higher on the agenda. We engage with a lot of future clients or people in the marketplace around value for money. We've done a lot of work in terms of the long-term value creation for private markets and how the upfront cost can be offset by not just the impact to the master trust and how they attract new clients, but actually to the beneficiary. So you can take case studies of middle-income earners, low-income earners, and the overall impact to their drawdown later in life by investing today in that long-term asset is quite profound, and it has a meaningful change later in life. And I think the more we communicate in that way is beneficial, not just to what Rachel Reeves is trying to achieve with investment into the UK and through more private assets, but also to the normal human being on the street. I can see the impact. And if we communicate in that way, people will take that as more normative, that's how I should think about my pension rather than what's the pot size? You know, what's the impact on drawdown and how does that affect me later? I think the other really good thing that I think is changing is also the emotional engagement around private markets. It's much more real and tangible.
Yeah.
We've been doing a lot around videos and kind of seeing the impact that one person's pension pot can create in a locality in the UK, further afield to social housing, to getting people off the street, for example, or for reducing air miles, because you can grow crops here in the UK that you wouldn't normally have done. I think they really help to bring alive the pension story. So again, to the normal person, you can relate to it. You can see it in real time. It's not something that is it's too complicated for me to understand. I'm sure that the pension provider is taking care of it for me. And those stories are relatable. And, you know, the likes of myself and Rich or whoever can have a conversation about that. Oh, I'm doing something cool. And you can get a push notification through your app.
Yeah.
And that's really helping in creating that environment where people say, I want more of that.
Yeah, they feel engaged.
Yeah.
A crucial part of the VFM framework as well that the government and FCA are relying on is the consolidation of pension funds. Rich, can you sort of shine a bit of light on what impact that might have on the market, both from a value perspective, but also on a performance basis as well?
Well, look, I should say that is one of the things in this change that is controversial. Now, the government would say it's pretty clear to us, and when they look at international examples, they are clearly Australia, convinced, Canada. Right? Yeah, exactly that being bigger scale gives you market power and efficiencies, gives you economies of scale, lets you hire better talent. Mm. To be honest, I don't think anyone would really argue with those. That's kind of pretty sound basic economics. The thing that you don't want to lose in that is innovation.
Yeah.
So I think that's the balance the government have got to strike. They want these schemes to be big enough to have all the things I've just talked about, but you still want them to have enough competitive edge, enough reason, enough fear of the others that they want to innovate, they want to communicate better, they want to really take the time to invest in their investment allocation so that it doesn't, so big doesn't become stodgy. You want big to become powerful.
Yeah. Do you think there was a danger in the initial proposals because they obviously got rid of the traffic light element of that VFM framework? Do you think there was a danger in the initial proposals that herding, I think was the word that everyone used?
Candidly, yes. And sort of we're on the record of this with our views that you want that to have teeth, right? If this framework doesn't have teeth, then what's the point? But if the sticks built into it are so sharp that really people find it too hard when push comes to shove to be honest with themselves if they've got a problem, then it doesn't work. And if all they do is look at one another, then
copy each other's homework.
Right, yeah. Then that doesn't help.
Yeah, but you can do really well your A levels, are you, if you do that?
But so can I come? I'd like to come back to mandation if I can, because like at the risk of bringing that N word back into the conversation, I can tell hairs have gone up on the arms of everybody listening. I do want to say, for the avoidance of doubt, because I think this is sometimes misunderstood, Schroders does not support outright kind of formal mandation. We never have. We think that's too blunt at all. What we do think, though, is not using that word. Can we have a better conversation about the relative underinvestment in our domestic economy from our domestic pension schemes?
And we were going to come on to that perhaps now is the time. The Mansion House Accord, which was signed by Schroders and 16 other firms earlier this year. I got that right, the compact and the accord.
Well, so just to clarify, not us, we would work with the asset owners who've signed that. But yeah, 90% of the market has signed
exactly.
that.
Exactly. What are your thoughts on that? I mean, 5% of investment in UK private markets by 2030. What opportunities can that bring? And but also that was also quite reliant on some things that the government needs to provide for the firms as well.
Look, I just think this is really positive, and I'm really pleased that. So look, of course, this happened in an atmosphere where everybody knew the government were looking at it. But notwithstanding that, this is the industry coming together themselves, negotiating the terms of this, signing this voluntary agreement. I think it's really positive. Because I'm a big fan of the research of New Financial, think tank, I think does great work.
Yeah.
If you go back a couple of reports, they've done research that kind of highlights really quite low allocations into these asset classes if you compare our pensions to pensions elsewhere. The stat I kind of love on this is there's actually twice as much private asset investment in UKDB at the moment than there is in UKDC. And that's crazy. DB is trying to manage to a specific promise and DC is just trying to grow. So that tells me there is a market failure, and I think the accord helps cut through that.
If not mandation, then perhaps one for both of you, but how do you get people to invest in these asset classes?
I think back to some of the stats we're seeing. I mean, it is about return. I mean, ultimately, it's the fiduciary responsibility of the schemes to deliver for the underlying. I think we have to do better on delivering the returns. I think we have to do better in delivering the opportunities to invest. So, you know, creating shop windows, creating structures that allow people to invest in this. And that is happening. You can see the proliferation of LTAFs in the marketplace. You can see some of the larger mass trusts investing and openly declaring what they're going to invest in, which is great. I think, you know, what we need to do then is just make sure that all parties are talking to each other. And this doesn't happen overnight. This is already happening with the conversations that we're having and certainly what we're seeing with our peers. This is underway. And I have no doubt this is underway. We've seen it through the LGPS over the last number of years where there's been vast amounts of money invested both locally here in the UK and further afield in private assets.
Yeah.
So I believe it's happening. I think we talk about it sometimes almost like it's over there and it's not really happening and it's an asset allocation framework that it hasn't been thought about. Of course it's been thought about. And I think many of the larger masters are doing some really interesting things. We just need to maybe vocalize them a little more.
Yeah.
And for me, where do we go next? So I really welcome all of this focus on private assets for all of the reasons Ronan's talked about, you know, returns, the story you can tell to your members, like really tangible. What I don't think has been spoken about enough are the UK's public markets. Now, again, some people just say, well, the reason we're not talking about them is because they don't perform very well. And then, okay, I get that, but
everyone's laughing.
But kind of zoom out. this is an ecosystem, and pensions 25 years ago, UK pensions had about 50% of their assets in UK listed equity, and that's now 4.9. Now, no one's saying we should go back to 50, but you can't look at the performance of that market in isolation from taking all of that capital out over a sustained period.
If you're saying if money floods out, then obviously it's going to perform worse.
You can get into a vicious, just like you can get into virtuous circles, you can get into vicious cycles.
Yeah.
And so that 4.9% number, let's pause on that for a bit. UK DC, 4.9% of their assets in domestic listed equity. The average, if you look at comparable pension schemes around the world, is 13. Mm. So that tells you that I think it's just a fact that we are investing less in our listed markets. So then the question is, do you care about that?
Yeah.
Now, I care about that. And I think that there's all sorts of reasons why that's important for your economy. But even if you just want a pragmatic one, Ronan's just talked about we're at the beginning of a journey under the Accord and in the private market space where UK pensions are going to buy more of the best UK private companies. Mm. If we don't tend to our public markets, where do we think they're going to go? And if they don't see listing in the UK as a viable option, then by definition, our pension schemes will inadvertently, now no one's meaning to do this, but as a fact, we're building a conveyor belt for our best companies to go overseas. And I think it's pretty obvious why we should care about that. That's jobs, tax, yeah. R&D. So that's where I'd like us to all go next. We've done great work to kind of lay all these foundations in private markets. Can we now talk about public markets?
That's something it sort of echoes what I've heard Torsten Bell say a number of times, that Australian and Canadian pension funds invest heavily here and they're not coming here for fun, I think he said.
Yeah. There's a stat from a while ago that, like, I can't remember which year it was, so this is not good for quoting. I think it was something like 2022. A Canadian pension fund made one single investment into a UK private company of 250 million. That was more than the investments from our entire pension system into private UK companies that year. Now, are we saying that that pension scheme was wrong?
Or
do you need to look at the other end of that telescope? I absolutely think that's true. The people aren't coming here because, you know, they've run out of things to buy. They're buying these things on merit as fiduciaries, like Ronan says. So I think we can as well.
Yeah. And Schroeder's over the last year or so, in fact, we met, I think, at PLSA or Pensions UK now in Edinburgh in March, where we both heard Future Growth Capital speak, a sort of a joined up between Phoenix and Schroeder's. Ronan, can you tell us a little bit about what work that's doing and sort of areas for investment?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, a lot of what they've been doing publicly, not in terms of investment, has been around the education and talking exactly what you've raised, which is the opportunity set and the idea that UK is probably the third largest market in the world for private equity investment and startup. And we've got great college systems. We've got the platform for delivery of companies. I think what we don't talk about enough is who are those companies and what do they do? And to Rich's point, what do they produce in the economy? Labor, cool ideas, you know, Revolut's a great story for the UK, kind of Monzo. Synthesia was recently talked about being bought by Adobe. I mean, there's some fabulous stories there. Yeah. I think we need to do better about publicly talking about them and elevating those stories so that people are aware of them. So they've been doing a lot of that. And then underneath the hood, they've been doing investing and looking at it from an open architecture perspective as who are best suited companies to make sure that we get access to those investment ideas that exist in, because there's two funds, one a global fund and very much a domestic fund. So it's very exciting engaging with pension schemes who then say, okay, let's start picking away at the storytelling bit underneath. Like, what are the exciting ideas and areas of investment that we can do, whether it's in the credit or the private equity side, or even deeper, we have a venture fund as well. So again, that's taking it to the next level when people are early in their private markets journey. How can we do UK venture capital? Mm. And that's really exciting to see that's now starting to become a conversation where...
Yeah.
Walk yourself back 3 or 4 years ago, you wouldn't have had that conversation.
Yeah,
I think that venture fund is so interesting because the government has put some money behind all of this drive.
Yeah.
The government is putting some money where their mouth is.
British Business Bank as well.
Exactly that. So it had a strange acronym. It was called LIFTS, but that's because it was about investing in life science and tech, hence why you get the strange acronym. But the British Business Bank ran a really, really rigorous kind of competitive competition for managers to partner up with asset owners and come forward with a proposal to invest in the best life science and tech companies, private companies in the UK. Now, Schroders, we were privileged to win that money. Actually, it's another partnership with Phoenix. And the British Business Bank put £250 million of public money into that. So again, sort of, if people are thinking, well, the government's talking all of this up, but what are they doing? Well, I think, again, we're at the beginning of a journey of them starting to think about that. Lyft was one of the first things they've done there, building on the BBB's track record. We've now got the West National Wealth Fund. New CEO has started there. Really interesting to see where that organisation goes, because I think the chance for the public sector and the private sector to invest together into the things we need, from private companies to bridges to roads to all of this kind of stuff, that then all of a sudden you are telling a story, just like Ronan was talking about, telling a story to pensioners about what that money is really doing in the UK. I think that's exciting.
Yeah, that is very exciting. Ronan, sort of following on from what Rich was saying just there, you both have done quite a lot of work in the Lifetime Savings Initiative. Can you explain a little bit about that and sort of around the person and what it means for the saver ultimately?
Yeah, I think I'll start, and Rich, please feel free to jump in. We did a study in which we published about 18 months, 2 years ago, and I think it was really interesting looking at the problem from the perspective of the beneficiary or the ordinary person in the street, and looking at what's affecting them post-skills crisis, talking about the cost of living crisis. All of these things were front page news. And there was three things that jumped off the page at us, and we pulled in all the raw data that could be applied to this across various regulatory boundaries, across different providers, etc. And it was really interesting, but it was really came down to everyday financial needs. Have I got enough money to pay for, you know, putting shoes on the kids' feet, you know, making sure we could pay for if the school uniform puncture in the tire, etc. And it's quite alarming, some of the numbers around that. We'll dig into that in a second. I think the one that's kind of more quoted in the press is certainly around housing and trying to get onto the property ladder, and the value that actually gives to an individual, both from a security perspective, but also later in life. And we'll touch upon some of this, the elements of that, and how that should dovetail with your pension benefits. And then the thing we have been talking about is just the long-term retirement needs. And if you're not getting the first two right, you know, how are you going to be in a position to save for the longer term when you're really fighting day to day? And I think that's not understood enough by many people when we talk about all the lovely things that we were talking about earlier, and, you know, value for money and people should be saving more, et cetera. But these are areas maybe we can explore a little bit. But
does that speak to the reticence for people to take risk, perhaps, with where they're allocating their pension?
Well, like, to be honest, I think it's because life's actually quite hard for quite a lot of people. And I don't want to bring the, I mean, we started talking about sexy, and this is going to bring us the mood right back down to ground. But to put some like numbers on what Ronan's just been talking about, that like everyday financial resilience question. Now, these numbers move around, but when we did the study, 46% of households had less than £1,000 saved, and something like 17% of households have nothing.
Yeah.
And then that means even a quite a small shock can wreck your finances. Like if your car breaks down, you can't afford to fix it, you can't get to work, all of a sudden, you're in a world of trouble. So how do we build up a kind of a basic buffer? And that housing one, I think the scariest stat in the whole project, and I really hadn't, this hadn't dawned on me until we did this work. I think probably lots of the people listening to this podcast just have an assumption that you're eventually going to end up owning your house. And that's what you'll live in when you retire. Mm. And maybe you'll downsize, but that's what you'll do.
Yeah.
But actually, the number of people who are going to have to rent their whole retirement is forecast to triple in the next 15 or 20 years.
Yeah.
So think about that. You've then got to pay rent for your whole retirement. Some of the Schroders analysts ran some numbers. We think if a 22-year-old joins work today and has to worry about that prospect, they're going to have to pay rent their whole retirement. They need to save 9% of their salary every year from day one.
Yeah. And they need that to pay their current rent, don't they? I
mean, right. And so if automatic enrollment at the moment, the minimum is 8%, well, this hypothetical rich Ronan or Julia needs 9% just to pay the rent. They've not done anything else yet. That's pretty terrifying. And it really showed me how important the link between housing and pensions is if you're trying to think about people's real lives.
There have been some suggestions I saw, in fact, at the launch of the Hargreaves data that you were speaking about earlier, Ronan, Luke Charters MP is quite supportive of the idea of releasing some pension money early to purchase a house. How do you both feel about that?
Well, interesting. I mean, because of the link between housing, financial security, but also just mental health as well, as in having that tangible asset. What we recommended to government, or one of the suggestions in our output of our report, having looked at not just what's happening here in the UK, but also drawing upon examples of saving systems overseas. So there's 7 or 8 of them that we looked at overseas. The key theme that ran through every one of the ones that we would use as models for our own DC saving system is flexibility. So being able to tap into the pensions in some very controlled way to be able to access it for certain events. And there's various iterations of it globally. And what we thought would be helpful is if above the auto-enrollment requirement of 8%, if someone is saving above that number, instead of having a tax advantage later in life at now 57, you could bring that forward for 2 reasons. One, if you're in debt and you had some financial advice of how to get out of that debt, use it to pay it off, because otherwise that again becomes a toxic burden for individuals. Or the other one is your first-time house. So you imagine a scenario of somebody joining the workforce at early 20s, saving just a little bit more than auto-enrollment requirement. And some of that is free money from companies that are employing them. Being able to use that buffer for your first-time house would be great. And it could release an awful lot of money. Some of the debates around, does that put a wave of money into housing? But we're trying to promote people onto the housing ladder to get that security, which provides them for later in life. Why wouldn't that be a good thing?
And look, whilst here, that idea that you do anything with pensions, we shouldn't touch them, the sacrosanct, that money is locked away. Well, as Ronan says, this idea, whilst quite novel here, is not new. Your pension can help you buy a house in Singapore, the United States, South America, Australia, New Zealand. Mm. In Singapore, it can help you pay your medical bills. In Chile, during COVID, they let people take small withdrawals from their pension
to live on,
to just help them through the crisis. 97% of people did it.
Wow.
So just when we looked around the world, pensions in the UK, even after pensions freedoms, unusually inflexible. So loads of other markets have sort of said, right, let's stand back. These pots of money don't live in isolation in the real world. In the real world, you think about where you live, you think about what's in your bank, you think about what is in your pension, and you look across all of them. So we should start to think that way about as policy, I think, as policymakers.
Do companies like Schroders, providers like Schroders and others, is there the capacity there to sort of monitor what people are taking out, though, and how do we go about doing this in a sensible and responsible way?
Do you know what? We thought about that quite a lot, and there's just lots of, I should say on all of these things, we're not claiming we've cracked it, but we published all of this online. And we want anyone to pick it up and use it. If there are government policymakers listening to it, I'd love them to pick it up. I'm sure they'll find the holes or the details that are important. When we thought about that, we thought you either need, if you're going to let people take big withdrawals, you probably do need some sort of gatekeeping around it to check that they're using it for the purpose. Mm. But if you're doing small withdrawals, I mean, maybe you can just trust people. I mean, it's their money eventually. Yeah. I think in Chile, they didn't set restrictions on it, I think, because it was only a small amount and they just trusted people to do what they wanted with it. Our house buying idea, you've got to be going through a regulated mortgage company or mortgage broker anyway. So, you know, if you've done it, you've got to fill in a ton of forms already, right? So we think there are gatekeepers that can help make this work. And like I say, other countries have made it work. So why don't we just go and talk to them, ask how they did it.
And the UK government is keen to follow other countries and their pension
policy. I think it creates a savings habit. I think one of the things that's not spoken about is, you know, changing that culture and engagement around pensions. We've talked in very structural ways today around value for money, about private market investing, around some of the issues that we found facing individuals. But that culture of investing, of being engaged actually with your pension scheme, and we talked about the impact private markets could have. The other impact could be, if I can get on a housing ladder at a young age, my pension becomes a beneficial tool to me early in life. So I'm going to talk about it. I'm going to be down the pub with my friends talking about it. But why not? You know, we laugh and smirk about it, but I think it's this very serious issue in terms of I've got a pool of capital that, to Richard's point, is mine. But now I can bring it forward for real benefit to me. I'm going to engage. I'm maximizing its return. I'm maximizing its investment return. I'm really interested in what's underneath the hood. we get into a very virtuous cycle here of actually, if the private markets are delivering returns and doing what they're saying on the tin, the end investor can get very, very happy with their pensions. And that could be nothing but a good thing.
And Julian, I think your point is a really good one. Luke is a really good example of a new intake MP. He's got new ideas.
He's young as well.
Right? Exactly that. And I think kind of that that's an important point. It was kind of half said in jest that I guess the listeners have presumed we're going to retire into our own home. Like, I'm not trying to be rude about anyone, but I do think it's important to connect with the kind of lived experience of this imaginary 22-year-old we're doing. The average age of buying that first house is getting further and further away from people. And look, I, 2 or 3 years ago, no one was talking about this. And if you had raised it, people would have said you were mad. And I saw that the idea of maybe being more flexible with pensions and thinking about housing was in a speech from the FCA the other day.
Yeah.
Right?
Or Athi, I think. Yeah.
So that shows you how far the debate has come in really not that long a time. Because I think, look, we're not the only ones doing this. Nest have done fantastic work on this. Hargreaves and their advocacy work shines a light on it. There are people doing more and more work showing that if we're going to plug these pension gaps, we need to think creatively, I think.
And Ronan, perhaps finally, financial literacy. You've done a lot of work in this area, and I think you, again, have brought in some statistics for us. How much of a concern is that for Schroders and others around, I suppose, comparatively to the US, that's the gold standard, isn't it? And perhaps the UK is not even bronze.
But I think, interesting you bring up the US, I think it's about engagement, as in they're very engaged with their 401ks. I think financial literacy, and one of the stats that alarmed myself and Rich was, and I'll read it off the page for you, I mean, 1 in 6 adults in England have the literacy level of a 5 to 7 year old. Now, just absorb that for a second. I mean, what that means in practical sense is if someone walks into a lift, they know to press the bottom right number, but they don't know what that number means, or you know, if it's a 6 or an 8. And that's real. So if we're at that level from a 1 in 6 adult, how can we ask them to make investment decisions? How can we ask them to be engaged with their savings or pensions, etc.? So we have to do better at schools. And it's great, last week the government has recommended that by 2028, you know, financial literacy will be part of the education system. There are other initiatives around the city that are being launched around bringing it into year sixes. And I think this is a very welcome development. I think we should all, not just Schroders, but as a wider investment community, should support that. Because if we get that right at early ages, it bleeds through to their future consumers. These are future consumers of DC in not very long time. And I think it's really important to give them the toolkit and the knowledge of how to make sensible decisions for their future, because this will be the central part of which they would invest in for their future and retire on later in life.
Yeah, and it's important that people are engaged, and that comes back to that central point that we've sort of spent most of today discussing.
Exactly. And again, early days, but I completely agree. I think that announcement last week is really important in this space. And also Schroders is involved in a kind of government sort of endorsed advertising campaign that we're working on with a number of other kind of brand names across the city to try and shift the focus from saving. Of course, if the first thing you're going to start doing with your finance, saving is the great place to start. Once you form that saving habit, how do we form the investment habit? And then look, those are the foothills of getting to that kind of 401k style engagement that we talk about.
Rich, Ronan, thanks so much for coming in to speak to me.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
But today is VE Day. The war is
the
over.
The crown queen waves from the Belfast.
Eagle has landed. Apollo 11 has
tearing
landed.
Down the Berlin Wall.
Since 1929, the Monks Investment Trust's mission has been to help investors grow their wealth. We aim to do this today by taking a three-dimensional approach to growth. Cyclical growth, rapid growth, and steady growth.
The World Wide Web.
Wall Street is in turmoil as stocks crash.
The Monks Investment Trust, managed by Baillie Gifford. Capital at risk.